KLYT Broadcast Studios. This is ABQ Connect with Jim Williams.
ABQ Connect is sponsored in part by Bosque Home Services, heating, cooling, plumbing, roofing, and restoration services. 505-444-7200. That's 505-444-7200. Or on the web at HVACAlbuquerqueNM.com. Bosque Home Services, locally grown, locally owned. Thank you for your support of KLYT and our show, ABQ Connect. We are with Mike Howell. He's a senior advisor for government relations at the Heritage Foundation. Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, you're gracious to give us twice in 1 month, and we may just keep trying to drag you back on the radio with us. Hey, tell us a little bit about the mission of the Heritage Foundation. I know we had you on once, but I want to make sure our listeners become more and more familiar as we talk to you, Mike, each and every other second week.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Heritage Foundation is the nation's largest conservative think tank. And what that means is we're a research organization with experts, the best in the country, devoted to some of our most important policy areas that, you know, affect the federal, state, and local. Whether it's, you know, domestic affairs or foreign affairs, we go out and get some of the best thinkers out there, and we have them really drive at policy solutions with a conservative ideology behind them that policymakers can use to advance, hopefully, you know, good legislation or oppose bad legislation. It's also meant to equip, you know, people throughout the country, you know, whether they're our members or anyone in the public writ large, with kind of the basic understanding and information that they need to engage as an informed citizen in this country. And so while we are located in Washington, D.C., because, you know, that's where our capital is, and I'm just a couple blocks from the Capitol right now, we also have a nationwide presence and a major, you know, media communications reach, because this is a fight that's going on across the country. We're just happen to be based here in Washington, D.C.
Mike, I went onto your website, heritage.org. I want to make all of our listeners aware of that website. Fascinating things, and you've got a little deal to the left side when you open up the homepage. It says latest, and there's all kinds of great articles. So I just grabbed four or five things today, and the one that I found the most puzzling was an article by Matthew Dickerson, a commentary he made about what's called parity funding. I've never heard of that. And after our listeners hear about it, they're probably not going to want to hear about it either.
Yeah, this gets into the wonky area of budget kind of policy. So one of the reasons you probably haven't heard about it is because Congress really hasn't passed any sort of new government funding in recent years. We kind of govern by what is known as a continuing resolution. So let me back up for a second. The way it's supposed to happen is Congress is supposed to set a budget, you know, which is the overall number, just like you and your family do. And then within that budget, they're supposed to go out and through the appropriations committees, which are appropriations committees for various departments and areas, they need to work within that budget to come up with appropriations, which are the money that goes to fund these programs. And then at the end of this whole process, you'll arrive with a bunch of appropriation bills that fit within the overall budget number. And then the Congress votes on it, both the House and Senate, and then it becomes a law once the president signs it. Unfortunately, what happens now is we basically can't get agreements on any of this stuff, and we can't go through these process of the actual hard work of setting a budget, determining the needs and what how the money should be spent via appropriations. So we do what's called continuing resolution. That means we're just going to take the same one that y'all had last time and keep it going. So it's a really lazy way to fund the government. It's why every so long you hear about, you know, impending government shutdowns if they can't agree to a continuing resolution. So what is parity funding? So in the ideal system where they actually do a budget and the appropriations, like we discussed that they don't do now, there's been this consensus on Capitol Hill that any increases over the previous year's budget should be matched evenly between defense and non-defense. This makes sense only for political reasons. It's a way to get, you know, defense hawks and then social spending advocates to able to agree. Where it doesn't make any sense is for policy reasons. Obviously, not every year is there a rationale to raise non-defense spending the same amount as defense spending. A lot of the non-defense spending isn't a core function of our government. You know, the primary function of our government is to keep us safe. So the argument for defense spending is there. Some years, there's not an argument for increasing non-defense spending by that much, especially when you realize that non-defense spending and spending overall is really driven by a few things that are what we like to call mandatory programs. Those are programs that don't go through this appropriations process. That's Medicare spending and Social Security primarily. And so those numbers can be getting out of control and not affect this kind of overall parity because the non-defense is going up anyway. So it gets kind of complicated pretty fast. But the basic point is when you're looking at reducing the federal debt and deficit, you need to make hard choices and set priorities. You cannot do that when you remove your ability to make a hard choice by being locked into this parity spending where everything has to increase along with everything else. We need our policymakers to be the adults in the room and sit and decide what we need to fund less and get rid of altogether. And you can't do that when the swamp is all tied together that, hey, so long as you get your, you know, $3 billion there, I get my $3 billion here. That's a recipe for a blown-up budget, and it's time for it to go.
I'm fascinated, Mike, because I don't think, at least me, I did not know how this all works. So we appreciate you explaining this in this process. But just the thinking to start off with seems wrong. And here's another issue that I find to be fascinating. And I want to ask you about the Heritage Foundation and why you are protecting unborn children. Why is that a priority for you?
Yeah, well, it's probably the top priority here. And we were just so blessed to have the March for Life in Washington, D.C. last Friday. And then we hosted hundreds and hundreds of families and individuals who came up to march for life in our nation's capital. And one of the reasons, you know, it's so important to us is because we have a commitment to, you know, the constitutional rights and of life, liberty, and happiness. And it flows from that those rights are also guaranteed to the unborn who have unfortunately been, you know, under assault by a rash of terrible Supreme Court precedents in a culture that has become so adverse to life. So we fight this battle on a lot of different fronts for the unborn. One of them is the legal front. We're very excited that the Supreme Court will this year be hearing a case called Dobbs versus Jackson, Mississippi, where we hope Roe v. Wade can be overturned once and for all and return to the states deciding as to what their laws should be concerning life. But it doesn't end there. This is also a cultural issue. It's a healthy country shouldn't want this much abortion. And so we try to, you know, use a lot of our tools and reach to really spread the word and the stories and the truth about the value of life. And so this is a top priority for us here, if not the absolute top. And I think this is going to be the year where we see finally the pro-life movement notch the most major and elusive victory, and that is overturning Roe v. Wade. And once that happens and the issue returns to the states, we're going to have to fight a battle on 50 different fronts in every single state. And that's where the advantage of being such a large national organization like ours really comes into play, because we're going to have to be working with 50 different legislators and in public to really make sure that the laws that go into effect in those states protect life.
The Heritage Foundation can be found at heritage.org. They have a ton of free information available to you, but you also like people to join your organization and be part of the process, don't you, Mike?
Yes, absolutely. We couldn't do it without our members. And so I encourage you to join and support us in this. If you go to our website, heritage.org, it's just right there at the top. And it's, you know, it doesn't cost much. Well, we're just happy to have as many people as part of this and rowing in the same direction, and your work your contributions directly support, I think, some of the necessary ammunition that is required in this battle we have right now for the soul of the country. Day in, day out, we're fighting to make sure that policymakers and the public have the info that they need and the arguments are being advocated for. And that is such an important thing.
Mike, the Biden administration is still talking about unemployment numbers being really low, but we talked last time about Rachel Gressler's article about the fact that people are leaving the workforce, and there's millions and millions of people that are no longer at work, but they're not counted in the unemployment numbers because they've literally left the workforce. How is that happening, and what can we do about it?
Right. Well, it's happening for a few reasons. I mean, some of them have to do with the pandemic and then the resulting lockdowns and paying people not to work and then encouraging people into unemployment insurance and in a culture of dependency and federal entitlements. And so when those people make the decision that they're not going to go back to work, that's not really reflected in the statistics that you hear politicians going on and talking about when they say about unemployment numbers. Because if you stop looking for work, you drop out of that overall calculation. The same goes for disability claims and then all other sorts of reasons why in this economy some people are actively not searching. It has to do with, you know, the fact that it is different environment right now in terms of employment than, you know, 20, 30 years ago in terms of you can get one job and reasonably expect to have that job and that a pretty reasonable and predictable career path for the next, you know, 30 years or until you're ready to retire. We work in a much more commoditized and gig economy now where people are working the same jobs less and less, and there's not kind of that commitment to the employee anymore. And it has a lot of downfield ramifications, not just in our economics, but and we as conservatives don't talk about this enough, but it also has huge ramifications in our families, in our culture, because employment, it gives such value in meaning and pride to individuals, and that is passed on through the family. And once you start moving towards this place where work is not as common and is not as valued in our society and culture, you start seeing a host of other problems creep in, ranging from divorce to drug abuse to depression and suicide, drug use. And so when you hear these unemployment numbers, first off, they're not necessarily accurate. It's politicians spinning their version of the data to you. But also remember, they tell a much bigger story than just the overall health of the economy. It's really the overall health and wellness of our people.
Mike Hall is a senior advisor for government relations at the Heritage Foundation, and he's got another segment with us, Mike. So I hope you'll hang on. We'd love talking to you about all of this different stuff. I just went into the latest on heritage.org and pulled these topics down this morning. There's a lot more detailed information than what Mike will have time to go over with us today. And then you can always go in and look at all the other resources available at heritage.org. That's the Heritage Foundation. We'll be back with Mike Howell right after these messages.
Saturday nights at 8 and Sunday evenings at 6 p.m. The new show, Tracks of Light.
Get your eyes, see another world.
We trace back where we got on track with the light of Christ. Tracks of Light, locally sponsored by theplaceilike.com.
When Neil Armstrong took man's first step on the moon, the whole world watched, and his first words are well known.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
What is not common knowledge is that the first meal on the moon was the Last Supper. Here's Levi Lesko to discuss his new book, The Last Supper on the Moon.
This book, Last Supper on the Moon, it begins with Buzz Aldrin, 1969, July, summer, on the lunar surface, before Neil Armstrong gets out of the Eagle to take that famous first step on the moon, the giant leap. But just before that, Buzz Aldrin opened a pouch and took out wine and bread, representing the body and blood of Jesus Christ, and he had a personal communion service. And that moment, when I found out about it about a year previously, hit me like a thunderbolt, you know, just to realize that the first thing ever eaten on the moon was the Last Supper.
The Last Supper on the Moon is an epic new hardcover book by Levi Lesko, and it's our resource offer this month. Receive your copy when you give a gift of $35 or more to support this program. Just go to connectwithskip.com or call 1-800-922-1888. That's connectwithskip.com or call 1-800-922-1888.
Hey, West Side, Pastor Drew here. If you are looking for a small church community plus world-class Bible teaching, I want to invite you to Calvary Church Westside. We're a family-focused Bible teaching church at Coors Montano. Calvary Church Westside, where church is family.
You're listening to KLYT. Welcome back to ABQ Connect with Jim Williams.
We want to thank Ben Lucero and Indigo Mortgage for supporting the ministry of KLYT and ABQ Connect. Indigo Mortgage, 505-836-5700. That's 505-836-5700 or on the web at indigomortgage.net. Thank you, Indigo Mortgage, for your support of KLYT and ABQ Connect. We are with Mike Howell. He's a senior advisor for government relations at the Heritage Foundation, and he's out based out in Washington, D.C. Mike, you enjoy living out there?
I used to. I had to move quite a bit out from the city into Maryland after the riots of last summer. I lived here for 6-7 years, but just like a lot of other cities across the country, with the rise in kind of police being defunded and prosecutors who won't, you know, keep areas safe, the city just unfortunately went, you know, down the tubes. And so Levi did, and tens and tens of thousands of people have done the same thing in D.C., and that's the story across the country right now.
Mike, I've mentioned a couple times that just going to your website and spending maybe 15, 30 minutes a day, you can learn a lot about our government. Like, for example, I didn't know that the Federal Election Campaign Act barred foreign governments, entities, and individuals from contributing directly or indirectly to candidates and political parties. In other words, they're supposed to have hands off when it comes to our election. Are foreigners now influencing voters and elections in the U.S.?
Oh, 100%, absolutely, and it's so obvious and widespread that it really goes without being noticed because we're so used to it. One area that's happening recently is the push to include illegal aliens, people shouldn't be in the country at all, voting in local elections. This is the case up in New York. California's messed around with this as well. That's what the left wants to do. They want illegal aliens to vote. That's why they're so pro-open borders. And they think that they'll vote for them more likely than Republicans who want to remove them. So that's a huge way in which foreigners influence elections. I mean, look no further than Kristen Sinema, who was out a couple months ago teaching a class, I think, in Arizona State. And a group of illegal aliens accosted her in the restroom. That is definitely foreigners influencing our elections and our elected officials when you're chasing senators into bathrooms to scream at them without recourse. Another huge way they do this is through the embassies here in the United States. They are constantly, especially the Mexican embassy. Think, if you're Mexico, what's your biggest cash cow, really? It's illegal aliens from Mexico sending money back from the U.S. to Mexico. And then fighting for all these leftist types of immigration policies to make immigration more common, that they can do more of it. And so they advocate through the embassies on a lot of these policy issues. And then there are nonprofit groups who are activist groups that are, you know, in wide part funded by foreigners and staffed by foreigners who are meant to be basically influence megaphones. I mean, look at kind of our cable news. A lot of these multinational corporations that are the owners of our major media outlets in the U.S. have huge foreign inputs into them. The New York Times is owned by a foreigner, the biggest newspaper I can think of. So the list goes on and on and on. It's a question of whether foreigners are influencing American politics as much as – are they influencing it more than Americans?
Yeah, I was even going to ask if Americans even have any influence anymore. It sounds like it's dwindling.
Yeah, it certainly is, and especially when basically there's only one political party in this country that actually is standing up for American sovereignty and patriotism. And so we've already lost – it didn't always used to be this way. In the 80s and, you know, before, at least two parties could have a claim towards just competing visions of how to get their best in a way that was consistent with our patriotism and our, you know, sovereignty and in the best interests of America. That's not the case anymore. The real battle for the soul of the country is over, you know, a group of people, conservatives, who are patriotic and want to save this country and do not think it is irredeemably racist and an awful place, versus another competing movement on the left who views this country as fundamentally, inherently racist, that all of the benefits in this country flow to the wrong people. We need to basically pick over the carcass of the United States to re-divvy up everything to other groups who we want to invite into the U.S. to repopulate it. That is a really stark division in our international discourse.
Well, Mike, it's interesting that you mentioned that because I have a pastor. He's actually from Albuquerque, New Mexico. His name is Clarence Washington Sr. He's written a 4-book series called Hijacked, How Dr. King's Dream Has Become a Nightmare. And he basically believes that the speech given in 1963 by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was an outline for how America, through forgiveness, humility, and working together, could bring America together. And of course, that's what he did in peaceful protest. It's fascinating to me because I have him on the radio a week or so ago, and then all of a sudden I get a whole bunch of people criticizing Dr. King and his personal position as a Christian. And I'm thinking to myself, well, I hope they don't hold me to those same terms because I'm going to fail miserably. You know, all of us are flawed, but what God did through Dr. King, I believe, was amazing. People by the thousands peacefully protesting, standing up for their rights, but in a nonviolent way. And Clarence Washington has written a book showing how that dream has really been abandoned, and he calls it hijacked. When you start hearing about Black Lives Matter and all these other organizations, they are not adhering to the dream Dr. King outlined. Humility, forgiveness, those are not part of their rhetoric.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. It's certainly not part of their rhetoric. I do think that the legacy of Martin Luther King is one that's been a little bit confused in our history teaching of it. I think his speech on I Have a Dream should be the ideal towards which we strive to be an actual colorblind society. But then on the other hand, there's a lot more that was said and written by Dr. King outside of that context, which included a lot of things we're seeing pop up in the radical CRT movement of today. And what I mean by that are quotas for affirmative action and redistribution, boycotts and those sorts of things. So there are some similarities between what Dr. King was asking for and even to a certain extent, support of non-peaceful action. And so it's a complicated story, but I think if you were to judge Dr. King by the I Have a Dream speech and the dream for a colorblind society, it's absolutely true that today's modern left does not seek a colorblind society whatsoever. They want the color of people's skin to be the most dominant and first and foremost thing about them. And that's something which I could not disagree with more.
Now, when you say that, that seems so clear to me, that's true, that there's actually more division being caused by this rhetoric than unity. But is our society just blind or not able to make that connection?
I think it's a combination of two things. One is Americans, and particularly white Americans, have an enormous capacity for guilt. And I think that emotion in terms of the racial history of this country is being played upon by a other side of the movement, which understands that race is their most powerful weapon, the race card. And so that's why you see it thrown around in every sort of political and policy context and as the really prime focus of every initiative that's on their side. Because they know it gets results and people will cower in fear once the race card is thrown around. And so as a country, I don't think we can expect race to ever become less of the front and center issue until, frankly, people are willing to say, we're not a racist country. I disagree with this. I have nothing to feel guilty about as an American who was born after slavery and all of that, that we're just going to move on from this and start treating each other equally. Finally, let's get to it. Everyone's equal. Let's move on.
Mike, you're gracious with your words, and I wish we could get more and more into detail, but our program would have to last about 6 hours to do that. So I'm going to go to my last question for you today or my last topic, I should say, maybe 2 or 3 subtopics underneath it. But what are your concerns about Joe Biden's new domestic terrorism unit?
Well, look, they're manifold. This is a president and administration that is absolutely bent on the notion that they can use federal law enforcement to target conservatives and everyday people. And they're doing that under the guise of there being some radical right-wing militia, white supremacist problem in this country, which could not be further from the truth. Sure, there are some individual bad people out there in every sort of political group and subset. But that doesn't mean that the prime and top focus of federal law enforcement, as Biden said, should be focusing in on this threat that doesn't exist. And so this is what we saw that they did with the FBI and parents when they said that if a parent poses critical race theory, they're a domestic terrorist. We can't trust this federal government and this administration to honestly assess even whether someone is a domestic terrorist or not anymore. There are some good examples of this. Joe Biden called Kyle Rittenhouse a white supremacist, a guy who shot two white people, one a pedophile and the other a big-time criminal, who were attacking him. They called that kid a white supremacist, Kyle Rittenhouse. He was found not only to be innocent, but to have no racial animus whatsoever motivating his attack. So in a very high-profile situation of determining whether someone's a quote-unquote domestic terrorist or not, they could not have been more wrong, and Biden refused to apologize. Now let's look at this radical Islamic extremist who held up held ransom a synagogue recently. The FBI initially came out and said there's no evidence of anti-Semitism. Come on now. It was obvious. People just don't go holding up synagogues for the fun of it. This administration is too political, too woke, honestly, too anti everything that our nation's founding, that they just want to demonize, particularly white Christians. That they can't be trusted to do anything in this area. And so I expect that this unit will be an absolute abuse of their power, just like virtually everything else they're doing.
Yeah, it's a scary thought to think about that. I have the word Gestapo in my brain.
Yeah, I don't think that's too far off.
Yeah. Mike, you're so gracious again. Thank you so much for joining us today on ABQ Connect. Mike Howell is a senior advisor for government relations at the Heritage Foundation. Heritage.org is the website, and you can get a lot of information. Thanks, Mike, so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. We'll chat next time.